Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Fuel and Fire. Oil and gas could have a new rival, and that's the methane locked up in the huge coal beds that lie under Alberta. Dr. Bill Gunter is working on new technology that would not only release this methane as a source of fuel, it would also provide an underground sink for carbon dioxide that's contributing to the greenhouse effect. And forest ecologist Dr. Steve Cumming got a bee in his bonnet at a recent symposium. A debate over whether fire suppression is effective sparked his own efforts to develop a model that could prove it one way or another. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Many people look upon coal as a dirty source of energy. Emissions of carbon dioxide contribute to the greenhouse effect that's altering our climate. Yet our coal resource is huge, and with new technologies, coal is also being looked upon as an important fuel for the future as we make the transition from fossil energy to other forms. Dr. Bill Gunter is with the Applied Geochemistry and Climate Change Technologies Unit at the Alberta Research Council. He's working on a project that would turn coal-fired power plants into closed-loop systems. Carbon dioxide would be pumped into the ground instead of the atmosphere. And in doing so, the CO2 would then force methane gas out of the coal beds and up another pipe to fuel the power plant.
Well, coal bed methane is an interesting resource that is very young in the sense that it was recognized as a safety hazard in mining for a long period of time. It was only in the 1980s when they were trying to lessen the problems they had with mine explosions that they actually developed the and recovery of coal bed methane, initially associated with mining, and now as a separate industry in the U.S. And it was done to degas mines and make them safer for miners. However, nowadays we're looking at coals that will never be mined. They're much deeper, and they're providing large amounts of coal bed methane. For example, in the U.S., current production of coal bed methane is more than a trillion cubic feet a year, which is more than 6% of the total natural gas that the U.S. uses currently.
How would we use the coal bed methane once we actually got it out of the ground?
Well, coal bed methane can be used for lots of things. Coal bed methane is very similar to the natural gas that we're used to, which we use in Alberta for our heating and sometimes for our cooking, and it can be used in exactly the same fashion. It uses the same types of pipelines that natural gas uses, so that the infrastructure is exactly the same, and it also can be used to generate power.
Where exactly is this methane in the coal beds? How does it get there?
Conventionally, we've always thought of coal as the source of energy. And now we're looking at a second benefit of coal, and that's the coal bed methane that's trapped in the coal. It's the formation of coal is, we know, is a long process. It's involved with the decay of plant matter on the surface of the earth in swamps, which goes through burial and goes through a sequence of being converted first to peat, then to a low-grade coal called lignite, and then through bituminous coal, and finally anthracite, which is the highest-grade coal. During that period of time, the coal is becoming more carbon-rich, and it's being dewatered and also going underneath chemical reactions as it's being buried deeper and the temperatures are becoming warmer. And gases are released, and both CO2 and methane are released. And in fact, the coal, as it runs through to the bituminous stage, generates more methane than it can hold. So a lot of this methane escapes and is often found trapped elsewhere in the geological structures and produced there. But there's still a lot of it that is retained. And up until the last 25 years, it wasn't realized that it could be produced economically. The reason that it's fascinating is the sense that it's stored much differently than conventional oil and gas, which are stored in pore space, in sediments, in these large sedimentary basins, of which the Alberta Basin is one of the world's largest. It actually is stored by absorption onto the coal. And just to draw an example, the activated charcoal, which is a form of coal or carbon, that is commonly used in gas masks for filtering out gases, it's used the same process to store the gas as coal does.
Now, the work that you're doing at the Research Council is you're looking at two things, not just how can you get this coal bed methane out of the ground and up so that we can use it, but you're also looking at a way of dealing with it in an environmentally a more responsible way so that we can start dealing with some of the CO2 emissions that go into the atmosphere. What exactly are you doing?
We're looking at trying to find ways to reduce CO2 emissions to the atmosphere and consequently lower the greenhouse gas effect on the Earth climate. And one of the options, that's been widely touted is, of course, the growing of forests et cetera. And Canada, of course, is well positioned to grow more trees. But another one, which isn't so widely known, but is I think is equally of equal magnitude, is storing the CO2 in the Earth's surface in depleted oil and gas reservoirs. Because as you produce fossil fuels from the sedimentary basin, you're actually freeing up pore space, and you can refill that pore space with CO2. In the case of coal bed methane, it's interesting because the storage of the gas is different than for conventional gas reservoirs in that it's absorbed. And CO2 absorbs much more strongly than methane. So most of the coals in Alberta are rich in methane that's trapped on the coal surfaces. And so if we actually inject CO2 into these coal seams, it will replace the methane or release the methane, which can actually be produced, and it will be trapped in these coals just as the methane was trapped. So essentially we get a two-for-one in the fact that it takes two molecules of CO2 to displace one of methane. And so the two molecules of CO2 are trapped. So if you just do a simple mass balance on the energy, if we were going to burn that gas for energy, we would only we would oxidize the methane and create one molecule of CO2. And if we want to replace that methane and burn more, we'd need an additional molecule of CO2. So in fact, I think if you do the simple arithmetic, it's a very attractive solution to lowering greenhouse gas emissions where we're combusting fossil fuels for energy use.
So does this mean then that in a power plant, an existing power plant, that instead of the CO2 going up the smokestack, you'd actually have that going down into the ground? So the smokestack would be turned upside down and become a well. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice analogy, which I haven't thought of, and I'll use myself in the future. I think it fits in very well with the concept that people have been talking about of the zero-emission coal, in which your whole plant, the process confines all the waste streams from the plant, and they're used beneficially for other processes. And this is just an example of using the gas waste stream for another process.
Where are you at now in terms of developing the process that would make this work?
We've been doing field tests for the last 3 years at Fenbig Valley, which is just south of Stettler. And these have been what we call micropilots or single well tests. And what we do there is we inject gas for a period of time. We then let it, we close a well in and let it soak in the reservoir and absorb to the coal. And then we produce it back in what's called a huff and puff test. And what we're doing during that time is measuring the compositions, the pressures, and the flow rates. And from that, we can assess, what the best process would be to recover the methane from the coal and to inject the CO2 in the coal. The huff and puff mode that we use is just a well test. It's cheaper because we're using a single well. We would never produce it economically that way. It would always be in a what's called a drive, where we're injecting gas in one well and producing from another, so that the CO2 is being trapped around the one well and driving the methane to the other well. And we're hoping that in 2002 we're going to have a multi-well test, which would be the next step in development of the technology. From that, if that's successful, our micropilot, we've run four micropilots which have been successful. If our multi-well test is successful, it will run for a year. Then we'll scale that up to a full-scale pilot, which would be a five-well test. And that would probably run for 2 years. And then if that's successful, we'd be looking at a multi-pattern test, which would involve about 40 wells and which would be a commercial demonstration. So the whole development of the technology is going to take from today probably in the order of 5 to 10 years.
How much coal bed methane do we actually have?
We have a huge amount of coal bed methane as a resource. We have estimates are over 200 TCF, which if you compare that to the usage of Canada for natural gas, is in the order of 100 years. The problem is that it's difficult to recover. And companies are working diligently over the past year to exploit this resource in a what we call a primary mode, where the natural pressure that's provided by the reservoir drives the coal bed methane to the surface when you've actually located a well in the reservoir.
Is anyone else working on this?
Well, there's a number of components. There's a lot of interest in the gas separation side in terms of the, lowering the costs, and so the utilities are looking at that fairly closely. CO2 is not only used, could be useful for enhanced coal bed methane, but it also, in enhanced oil recovery, is a mature industry. In Saskatchewan, we have one of the biggest enhanced oil recovery projects in the world, where they're actually pumping 4,000 tons of CO2 per day into the Weyburn Reservoir in an operation that's a true partnership between Pan-Canadian and a company in the U.S. called North Dakota Synfuels, where they're gasifying coal and supplying the CO2 by pipeline to the reservoir in Saskatchewan. So in terms of enhanced coal bed methane itself, there are a number of other pilots in progress. BP has just announced one in the southern U.S. in the San Juan Basin. Burlington Resources has one also in the San Juan Basin. Both companies are part of our project. And the most recently, TNO, a research organization much like the Alberta Research Council in the Netherlands, has announced a project they're going to carry out in Poland. So I think that the enhanced coal bed methane technology is going to be very important in the future, and is applicable to any areas of the world where there are large coal basins.
Well, I was just thinking about China.
China, and I just returned from China last week and spent 2 days talking to people in a workshop about coal bed methane, enhanced coal bed methane. And we are just at the end stages in negotiating a project with CETA to develop this technology also in China, in the Shanxi province, in the Qinshu sedimentary basin, one of the most polluted areas in China from coal-fired power plants. So we also have been talking to Australian partners in terms of this technology. And I think it, you know, it's not just going to be applicable to Alberta, but will be a technology that's applicable worldwide.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Dr. Bill Gunter is a distinguished scientist at the Alberta Research Council. He works on coal bed methane in the Applied Geochemistry and Climate Change Technology Unit there. Coming up, is putting out forest fires worth the effort? Thank you. Over the last few decades, tremendous amounts of money and effort have gone into fighting forest fires. We do so to protect human settlements and timber resources. At the same time, fire plays an important role in maintaining forest ecosystems. The year 2000 proved a very bad fire year in the United States particularly, with large fires burning out of control. This has led to an international debate among some scientists and legislators as to the effectiveness of fighting fires, or fire suppression. Dr. Steve Cumming is a forest ecologist who specializes in analyzing data and developing models for forest management. He figured this was one argument that needed more attention to hard evidence and less to spurious claims.
Yes, what inspired me to pick up some of my work on this was a symposium on this very subject at the recent meeting of the Ecological Society of America. There's a fair amount of current controversy in the scientific literature as well. Recent issues of Canadian journals have contained back-and-forth articles to the effect that there's no evidence. Yes, there is. Fire suppression works. No, it can't. And although it's quite correct to challenge the evidence that fire suppression has worked or hasn't worked, because the evidence isn't really very good, that doesn't mean that the issue can't be studied. And that's what I've been trying to do, is figure out some new approaches to look at the data that exists and try to determine whether there has been an effect or not, and if so, how you could estimate how big an effect there has been.
What are you doing?
What I'm trying to do is look a little bit more closely at what fire suppression really does, how it works mechanistically, figure out what kind of effect you would expect to see if these interventions were successful, and then develop ways of looking at the historical data and test for the presence of these effects.
What are some of the considerations that you have to factor into this? Do fires burn the same everywhere, or is that something that's different every forest that you go into?
As far as fire suppression and fire goes, I would say you could usefully imagine that there's two broad classes of forest. There's forests like the Ponderosa Pine dry belt forests in the western U.S. and a little bit in B.C. that historically were dominated by surface fires. Basically, you'd have an open canopy of trees far apart, great big ponderosa pine, for example, with grasslands or grassy forest floors that were dominated by herbs or grasses. And you just have very low-intensity surface fires, like prairie fires, if you like, spreading over those, that didn't kill the trees. In the boreal, crown fires are much more characteristic, where the actual fire burns through the crowns of the trees, and that's possible because the crowns are close together, they're touching, so they're a continuous source of fuels that can sustain these sorts of fires. The concern in parts of the U.S. is essentially that fire suppression has changed the dry belt forests, allowing trees to replace the grassland or the grasses underneath the bigger trees, so that now you have continuous fuels, and so the worry is that fire suppression has turned what would have been a surface fire system into a crown fire system. And crown fires are much more difficult to put out because they just release so much more energy when they're going.
What is it that you're actually doing?
Well, it's not so much I'm working with the computer. I'm doing statistical analyses of historical data sets. And one of the specific things that I'm looking at is a particular way that the Canadian agencies try to put out fires. You have to consider different stages of the fire process separately. There's different ways that you could attempt fire suppression. One is the sort of Smokey the Bear approach, put out your campfires sort of thing, so you're trying to prevent them from starting. In the forests that I study in northern Canada, though, most fires are started by lightning. Nothing much you can do about that. So given that a fire starts, the easiest way to put it out is to get there with the helicopters and the buckets of water very, very quickly before it becomes large. And much of our effort in Canada is expended in doing that. It's called initial attack. They try to get to the fire with a small crew of people transported by helicopter as quickly as they can and establish a fire line, dig a ditch or something, in hopes of putting the fire out or getting it under control quickly. In 1982, in the early 80s in Alberta, there were three very bad fire years where suppression resources were overwhelmed, large areas were burned, and in response to this, a more sophisticated system of fire suppression was developed that mainly has to do with predicting in advance where fires are likely to be and arranging for your helicopter crews to be conveniently located in case they actually happen. So the whole point is to deploy your resources very intelligently so that you're more likely to be able to respond quickly to fires that do start and get to them while they're small. So there's these two different kinds of changes, a change in strategy and a change in effort.
So where are you at now? What have you found out? What is the data telling you?
What I've found out so far is that since 1982, fires are about 50% less likely to become large than they used to be, or suppression effectiveness is twice as great, if you like, as it used to be. Now, there's a little bit more to it than that, however, because it might be that they've just gotten very good at putting out the simple, easy fires. Maybe it's the very big, bad fires that do most of the damage. Maybe those ones are still getting away on them, and really there isn't much of an effect. We have to consider one of the reasons for the controversy. And this reason is, in essence, there's very few fires that actually do most of the damage or burn most of the area. A very small number of big fires are responsible for almost all the area burned. These are associated with, you know, extreme weather conditions, dry, hot days with strong winds. It might be the case that all that fire suppression is doing and all that the data that I described is showing me is that they've just gotten better at putting out simple, small, inoffensive fires and might have had no effect at all on these big ones. There's a number of ways of testing that hypothesis, however, and it doesn't look like it's true. It seems to me that by looking a bit more closely at the sort of data that I have, you can test for year effects, you can test for climatic effects, and it appears that fire suppression is also effective even under extreme weather conditions.
So in bad years, as far as the weather goes, you're going to have a big fire. It's just a question of will it be really big or not quite as big. Is that it?
Well, there's actually two sides to that. Yes, in bad years, you could still have big fires, and demonstrably we do. The question is, do we have less of them than we would have had? Because if the helicopter gets there very quickly, it might put out a fire that would have become very large, and that does seem to be happening. But then there's a second question of, what about the fires that, quote, escape, that get to be big? You need a different kind of analysis to look at whether fire suppression can influence those types of fires, but my preliminary results indicate that it can. And if you consider how a fire gets to be 500,000 hectares in size, it's easy to see how that could work. There are times during the life of a fire like that when there's very little that fire suppression people can do except get out of the way. But there are other times when the wind dies down, maybe it rains a little bit, where the fire isn't growing as rapidly as at other times, where it's emitting less energy at other times, and where interventions are more likely to be effective. And my preliminary analysis of these sorts of data demonstrate that it is. So it isn't that fire suppression will stop a fire, will stop all fires at a small size, but you also have to consider that 1,000,000 hectares is a lot worse than 500,000 hectares. And that's the sort of question that you're dealing with. Can fire suppression for escaped fires by means of helicopters and bulldozers and all this sort of quasi-military effort that goes into these campaigns, can it make fires smaller than they would have been? And it's clear that they can, I think.
Now, we were looking at the fire pattern or the fire history for the Chinchaga fire, which was back in the 1950s. Could fire suppression have made a difference there?
That was probably the biggest fire ever known to have burned in Alberta. It was about 1,000,000 hectares. Started in BC, but burned across the border. And that fire was not really fought because it was pretty much wilderness at the time. There wasn't much resources, no people. For one reason or another, it wasn't fought. But what I have here, what I'm looking at right now as I speak to you, is a rough map of the fire that shows its boundaries at different times. And it burned from early June all the way to the end of October. But what one sees when one looks at this map is that there are times when the fire moved very rapidly and covered large areas in a very short period of time. And you can imagine what the fire would have looked like when it was doing that. It would have been a towering inferno, and there would have been very little that forest suppression firefighters could have done about it during those intervals when it was growing rapidly. There are other times, for example, the week of September 7th to 19th, where the fire was growing very slowly. And quite possibly, powerful intervention by water bombers and bulldozers and such as we now attempt to do these days would have been able to stop it at that time or at some other similar time during the history of the fire. So if that were true, and it seems reasonable that it would be true, then it might have prevented a 500,000-hectare fire, literally, from becoming a 1,000,000-hectare fire, which is a big difference and does argue, or suggest rather strongly, that fire suppression activities can work not just at the initial growth phase of the fire, but the initial attack phase that I call it, but can also influence the size of escaped fires. And I have also some statistical analyses that strongly indicate that that's the case.
Now that you've done all this work, what are you going to say the next time you find yourself in the middle of a debate or a discussion over whether or not fire suppression works?
Well, I hope to be able to point at a published paper on the subject because some of my research is about to be submitted to the scientific peer-reviewed literature. But I guess more what I would want to say is it's possible to analyze the available data rigorously in order to test specific claims about the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of fire suppression. The statistical methods for doing this kind of thing are pretty well known. They just haven't been applied to this problem before. It's not necessary to be arguing back and forth. What's useful or what should be done now is to more systematically pursue the lines of investigation that I'm suggesting.
And you'll be able to point to your new model, won't you?
I hope so.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Steve Cumming, a forest ecologist with Boreal Ecosystems Research Limited. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website. You can listen to past programs in real audio. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.